What I'd like to do this morning is to continue an occasional series that I've been doing over the year on the Eightfold Path. Eightfold Path is the primary way in which the Buddha talked about his path of practice, the journey. And so we've been going over this over the year, so we're now on the sixth of the Eightfold Path. So I want to back up a little bit and give some introduction to it, especially for those of you who are new. When a person encounters Buddhism, they probably come with certain preconceptions. And one preconception is that it's a religion. And religion has all these kind of tenets and practices. And as soon as you hear something that's Buddhist, it's a little bit different way of talking about things maybe you're used to, it starts sounding a little bit esoteric. Sounds like you're being asked to do something, you know, okay, you got to do this. And it's Buddhist practice stuff. And it can seem foreign to what we're about here in America. And so that foreignness can be an obstacle for people. Or other people are just so excited. They say, this is it, you know, just tell me what to do. This is a great religion. And they adopt it as if it's something esoteric and special and something, you know. And over the years that I've been practicing and studying, engaging in the teachings of the Buddha, some of the esoteric or the exotic quality of it kind of falls away. And as the exotic quality of it falls away, some of his teachings seem to be more and more ordinary, in the sense that he's talking about things that people do ordinary people do, what you do, all of you. And he has maybe a little bit fancy language of talking about it. But I find it very helpful to think about the Buddha's teaching. A starting point for Buddha's teaching, say, I'll listen to what he has to say, and then think, how do I already do this? As opposed to, okay, now I've got to do something strange. How am I already doing this? And what you find is that you don't have to do much analysis to realize that you're already doing a lot that he's teaching. And he's kind of building his teachings on common human behavior, and then directing in a certain direction, but it's not really asking you to do something that's foreign or strange from what you already do. And so if you can understand how you already do something, then it might be easier to kind of walk the path, because then it's just a matter of kind of nudging in a particular direction or enhancing it, developing it a little bit. So one of the really key teachings of Buddhism, which in a little while I'll tell you a little bit the more exotic term for it, and that will maybe turn some of you off when you hear the term. But one of the very important teachings is that your behavior, the choices you make, have consequences. And I think this is something that you all know really well. Even if you never thought about it, you know that you live a life that you're conscious of choices and behavior, and that choices and behavior have consequences. So, for example, it's as simple as realizing that you have choice about when it's appropriate to go to the bathroom, or when you need to go to the bathroom, and that your behavior around going to the bathroom has consequences. And we have certain consequences we would like for ourselves, and we'd like all of you. There are good consequences and not so nice consequences about the choices you make. Now, for all of you, you all know about those consequences and choices, and it seems effortless and natural, but behind that decision to go to the bathroom is an appreciation, understanding that you have choice, that those choices have consequences, and it's kind of so natural, so much part of who you are. My children, some of them when they're really young, they're still learning that it doesn't come automatically. Or there's kind of a natural sense of planning a little bit, you know, that the consequence. So I think you need to plan ahead a little bit. This idea of living in the present moment, So my son is really good at this, my young son, and very much in the present moment. And so yesterday we went to the park, where all the toilets are locked, And normally, when I take my son to the park, I plan ahead for him. you know, and so I said, you know, I think we should go to the bathroom before you go. But I didn't. I forgot. I'd forgotten that there are consequences. And that I needed to somehow take those into account. So we had to kind of deal with that at the park. And locked toilets and everything. So taking into account consequences, having the ability to project a little bit into the future, and imagine what the consequences can be, and making choices along those lines, what people do. You go driving in some rural countryside, and you look at your gas gauge, and you realize maybe you have a third of a tank of gas, and you realize, well, given where I'm driving, maybe not enough gas to have, because I don't know how often gas stations appear. And so I think I need to make a choice here to get gas. Or you can say, no, just be in the present moment and just kind of live with how things unfold. And that's nice, sure. Until you run out of gas and, you know, 100-degree weather in the middle of the Mojave Desert. And then you wished you had, you know, not just lived only in the present moment, but had anticipated the fact that you're living in a particular, you know, you're in a particular environment that calls for certain kind of choices and actions, and the choices you make or don't make have consequences. So what I'm trying to say, maybe in silly ways, is that that kind of behavior is something we all do. We realize our choices are consequential. Now we take one step further into our psychology. And so appreciating that our psychology also, there are choices we make there with our minds, our thoughts, our feelings, and those also have consequences. And if we don't take that into account, then and make choices along those lines, then we suffer, you know, or those consequences happen maybe not as we wish they would. And it can be as simple as how you drive your car. You have choice about how you drive your car. And there was a time in my life I didn't ever thought about the choice of how I drive my car. I just drove my car the way I did, or I chose to drive my car. And I learned, because of a number of near accidents, that maybe I should give a little bit more thought and choice about how I drive my car. I was choosing as it was. But like the choice, I remember once when I was 17, choosing to see how quickly I can get across the intersection when the light turned green. I had my father's kind of red little, you know, convertible, you know, and it wasn't really a fast car, but I kind of thought it was a kind of sports car. And I'll just see how fast I can get across the intersection. And it was a really good thing that I went as fast as I could, because as soon as the light turned green, I took off, not noticing to go straight across, not noticing that the light that had turned green was only the light for going left. And the people coming the other way had a left turn green light too. So luckily I got across before those people. That was a choice. So I realized, you know, I think I better make a choice to pay more attention when I'm driving. And that's a good choice to make. And look around. And the other choice is to drive a little more calmly. And calm, you know, if I ever have a personalized license plate, I thought of having that license plate says calm. I thought that'd be good for me and for other people to see that. So there are choices. And so those choices, the inner choices about how we choose to live our life, make a difference. So I could drive my car in such a way that I arrive wherever I'm going flustered or irritated or kind of exhausted. And I can drive my car in such a way that I arrive more refreshed. I can make choices about how much I fill my day with. There's a phenomena that I've had. I don't do it so much anymore. The phenomena of reading the newspaper at breakfast, and which before I had kids, I could kind of do to abandon. You know, I could read as much as I want. And so I sit there and read the newspaper. It's like one of these precious things in the morning for some people. And so these really important articles to read that in a week from now I won't remember. And so I'm sitting there reading, you know, the articles, and it's so nice to be there. And I'll push. Well, you know, I probably need to do the things I need to do to get ready. And I'll just a little bit more, one more minute. And then when I finally realize it's got to go, then to make lunches, get these two kids dressed, and you get out the door to the carpool and, you know, to school, it's like suddenly I'm harried and the kids are not cooperating. Those kids. If those kids would only behave, then you know, the world, I would just be able to have a good life. Those kids. You know. And so what I've learned is that not to read the newspaper so much. And if I give myself more time in the morning, I feel more refreshed, things go smoother, I can kind of give lots of space and support for the kids to do what they need to do to get ready. And then I can get out the door a little bit early, I can get to the carpool a little bit early, and it's a whole different feeling I have about how my inner life is actually quite different based on those choices. So far, I haven't said much about Buddhism. And this very simple teaching that your actions and choices have consequences is one of the primary foundations upon which Buddhist practice, the Buddha's teachings, are built. And so he's not saying anything, you know, exotic. However, the word that he chose for this concept is karma. Karma. Ooh. I'm not sure I believe in karma. Karma is a strange idea about rebirth and, you know, retribution and, you know, it's, you know, your karma will get you. And but it's just a very simple thing. It's, you know, that your actions and choices have consequences. And the opportunity of meditation practice, among other things, is to develop the kind of subtle sensitivity that you can see the subtle but quite consequential consequences of the inner choices you make about what you think, how you feel. One of the things when you sit down to meditate, there's choices you make about what you do with your mind. And now, there are times when I could say, I'm just going to let my mind do whatever it wants. I'm just going to be in the present moment and just let things be. And I can spend the whole 40 minutes, you know, planning a Dharma talk. Or on vacation, and, you know, in Half Moon Bay, on the beach, you know, or something else, you know. And I have to make some choice to let go of the current direction that my mind is going, if I'm caught up in my thoughts, and bring my attention to that, notice that, let go of it, turn my attention to the present moment if I'm really lost, show up for my breath, try to connect my breath. My mind is really busy. It keeps going into grooves of thinking. To make a little bit more, I can make a choice to make a little bit more effort. Gail, you've got to kind of apply yourself a little bit more here because your mind is not useful being so wandering around so much and you know, not being present at all. And there are choices that I can make. Now, sometimes the kind of, if I let my mind have too much of a free rein to think whatever it wants, I could start thinking about things which affect my emotional life. I've sat very peacefully and calmly and happily meditating, and out of the blue comes some thought about someone who has slighted me, maybe 30 or 40 years ago. And then my mind begins thinking about that a little bit, and I could feel the tightening and the heat and the energy kind of rising. And so if I kind of follow that track, you know, that heat will kind of get stronger and stronger. If I can be really present and see the arising of that memory, and see that if I stay with this memory and think about it, I'm going to feel the contraction develop, the heat develop, I have some choice about whether, do I follow that? Do I relate to this in a different way? Or do I just kind of let it, give it free rein? And I find it useful to kind of change my relationship to it, maybe change the direction in which my mind is going, maybe let go of it entirely. Maybe I don't need to think about 40 years ago. Maybe I do, but maybe I need to do it in a very much wiser way, more careful way. So this idea that our choices, we have choices. We have choices about what goes on in our minds and our thoughts and our inner life as well. And if we don't take responsibility for that, then the consequences of those thoughts and those impulses, those intentions, might have consequences which you'd rather not live by. And if you take some responsibility for it, then you can help create the conditions for consequences that are beneficial for you, helpful for you. So that's the basic idea of Buddha's, the foundation of Buddha's teaching is that your behavior has consequences. Now, given that, then are there particular consequences that are... What are the consequences that are most useful for you? And the Buddha had in mind a particular consequence that he thought was ideal or ultimate. And he called that liberation or awakening. And the idea of this is that you have to, you know, you could either suffer. That's one consequence. It's a whole different range of sufferings human beings can experience. Or you can become free of that suffering. And he was interested in that freedom from suffering. And you might think that the opposite of suffering is happiness. So he was teaching happiness. But I think maybe that's too limited. The opposite of suffering is freedom from suffering. And freedom from suffering has is much wider, more refreshing, more peaceful than usual concepts or ideas of happiness. So if you want those consequences, if you want the consequences of freedom, those consequences require certain choices in order to reach that. If you're not interested in freedom, if you're interested in suffering, if you want to suffer really well, then probably all of you know really well what choices to make. You've been making them really well for a long time, and you just get into it more. But if you want to become free of suffering and attain some degree of freedom, as the spiritual path the Buddha taught, you have to appreciate that you need to take some responsibility for choices that will lead you in that direction, or support you in that direction. So what are those choices? And the Eightfold Path represents some of those choices that a person can make. You're under no obligation to do it unless what you want to do is to kind of move in a direction of beneficially of awakening or freedom. And so the Eightfold Path sets into place those behavior, those choices which may be helpful. So earlier on we talked about choices that some of these choices that are talked explicitly have to do with how you speak. And you can create a tremendous amount of suffering in how you speak. And so choosing how you speak in such a way that you create conditions for happiness or freedom from suffering is very important. So be conscious about how you speak. The other is be conscious about how you behave in the world, your ethics. The third is have some consciousness around your livelihood, how you, the basic kind of ways in which you live your life. Now, the sixth topic for today is right effort. Right endeavor, right engagement. What you endeavor to do? What are the so this idea of actions have consequences? Then what endeavors, what actions are appropriate to pursue? And here, when you're talking about right effort, I think we're talking very much about the mind, the psychology, trying to look at and understand what's going on inside of us more than what's going on externally. The external choices, those are important. But when we get to the sixth or the Eightfold Path, we're beginning to really turn within and develop, use our mindfulness and concentration to begin appreciating what's going on in the mind, which is the genesis of our behavior to a great degree. So the right effort can seem, again, like an exotic teaching, but I'd like to suggest that it's something we all do by reframing it a little bit. The first... and if I give you the traditional wording of it, you'd all fall asleep if you're not already. It's kind of, it's kind of dry and a little bit complicated and convoluted. So it's a little bit hard to understand. But if I rephrase it, perhaps you'll see, oh yeah, I do that all the time. There's four right efforts. The four efforts you can make. The first effort is if you're in trouble, get out of trouble. Pretty good, right? I mean, you probably do that all the time. If you're in trouble, get out of trouble. If you're driving your car and you find yourself, in a wet spot and the car is skidding, that's called trouble. And it's, you get out of trouble. It's a natural thing to do. I used to live, I don't know, maybe this is not the best example, but I used to live in a variety of places and cities that were, people got mugged a lot. Dangerous places to live. And sometimes I would get in trouble in that kind of environment. I never got mugged, But there were people who, every indication gave, they were about to mug me. And so I learned what to do to get out of trouble. Sometimes it just meant crossing the street or, you know, walking away or something. And or you could you know, you find yourself talking a certain way to someone and you say something you regret. You say something and they're getting irritated and angry because you said something which was mean-spirited or insensitive to their situation. And so I'm in trouble in some way. So how do I get out of this trouble? And so you kind of apologize or you say, do something. So getting out of trouble. If you're in trouble, get out of trouble. The second of the right efforts is stay out of trouble. So, you know, don't do anything that puts you in trouble. So I learned when I lived in these cities where you got mugged, I learned there were certain streets you don't walk down. Certain alleys, at night, you don't even walk down these alleys. Because then you stay out of trouble. If you're in a tremendously aversive mood, ready to bite anybody's head off, then maybe you stay out of trouble by staying home for a while till you cool down. And that's a useful thing to do. Or if you... you realize that if you wait to the last possible second to get in your car to drive to work, that you're likely to get in trouble because the traffic is unreliable. And so you stay out of trouble by actually giving yourself 5 or 10 minutes extra time to drive. And so you kind of stay out of trouble. You can't keep out of trouble. So staying out of trouble is something human beings don't do all the time. It's a normal thing, right? I hope it's normal for you. The third right effort is develop good habits. Develop good skills. Start making good choices for yourself. So, leaving for work a little bit early. If you're living in an inner city where it's dangerous, there are certain skills which are really good. People skills are really good. So maybe you need to develop some good people skills. So when they come with a mugging, you can kind of say something wise or say, not today. But, I've known people, I've told these stories here, but I've known people who have been mugged and who had the wherewithal to actually engage the mugger in a wise way. And kind of dissipate the whole situation. And the people I know, because I hang out in kind of meditation circles, attributed their ability to do that to staying calm. So the ability to cultivate calm, which is one of the skills, to cultivate a habit or a skill or a good state, is really beneficial to cultivate calm. I know that for myself, if I don't sit every day, that my whole system, my body, builds up a certain degrees of stress within it. And it doesn't, if I sit every day, I don't build up stress in the same way if I don't. Somehow the meditation allows me to dissipate or relax or stay calm so that the stress doesn't accumulate or build up in my system in ways that are detrimental. So you start living in a way that supports good habits, good skills, good qualities of mind, good qualities of heart. And I think that many of us do this. In ways that not so unusual. And then the fourth of the four right efforts is keep your good habits up. Keep doing them. Don't let maintain them. Don't let them. So if you manage to some calm, keep the calm going. Sit every day to keep the calm, some level of calm or stability going. Anyway, so there's a variety of things. So those are the four. So stay out of trouble. No, get out of trouble. Stay out of trouble. Cultivate, develop yourself, develop good habits, and then maintain them. So that's what the Buddha said. So this is his way, I think, of categorizing, organizing, or explaining something human beings do all the time. So then the question is, since we do it all the time, and hopefully you recognize these things in yourself now, how is it that they're utilized to put yourself on the Eightfold Path, on the path to freedom? They're utilized, what's required, first and foremost, is you have to understand the purpose of the path. You have to understand that there is a certain consequence that's desirable, that you want. And so you're kind of making choices that along these four right efforts that are going to lead to those consequences. So, for example, if you choose to be cruel or choose to have a lot of ill will towards someone, that's understood to be getting yourself into trouble. That has consequences which are not helpful in this path of liberation and freedom. And so part of what we need to do is to develop the stability and the insight, be able to see, an aversive mind state has arisen, and I think it's better to figure out some way not to buy into it, not to get lost in it, not to act from it. Because if I do, that's going to have consequences. It's going to have real-world consequences, maybe you harm other people, hurt other people, and I'm angry at you. But it also has inner-world consequence, in that you might be setting in motion certain chain of psychological cause and effect in your own mind and heart, which are going to be detrimental for you. And there's a variety of those that might be set in motion. One is that every time you act on anger, you're probably reinforcing your tendency to get angry. You're probably reinforcing degrees of stress in your system. You might be reinforcing a certain numbness, certain kind of insensitivity to yourself and to others, because it's hard to hurt other people if you're really sensitive and present for what's going on. So this is a teaching of karma, and karma has a lot to do with this inner psychological world, that your choices have an effect on your inner psychology and have consequences here and now, but also down into the future. And Buddhism says, take some responsibility for your mind and heart here and now, but also for the consequences you're going to have into the future. So the ultimate purpose of Buddhism is liberation and freedom. So how is it that we can live these four right efforts to support the path of liberation? So again, we stay out of trouble. And if we're in trouble, we get out of trouble. And people are all kinds of trouble in this life. And it's really inspiring and very moving for me and very meaningful for me to have people who come to the center here who are struggling in their life because they're in trouble or there's some real difficulty that they're dealing with. There are people who come here who are dealing with various addiction problems, people who are dealing with tremendous ethical turmoil in their life, people who are dealing with interpersonal turmoil and difficulty, divorce, people who are dealing with illness issues. Some people come here when they have a chronic illness. It's really serious that they have. And maybe we don't want to call dying trouble, but often the process of dying, having some serious illness, creates a tremendous amount of turmoil. And so how do we cope with that and deal with it? And to me, it's very, very meaningful that our practice here of mindfulness is a practice which can address people who are in trouble, people who are struggling, people for whom there's a tremendous amount of suffering in their life. And often in ways that they can't see anything else. They don't see easy ways out of it. And so one of the things we teach then is to slowly begin teaching to make wise choices. And so, for example, if you have a problem with addiction of one form or another, you start making choices that maybe lessen your chance of succumbing to those. So, for example, you might, if you have a problem with alcohol, you're encouraged not to go to parties where there's alcohol, because that maybe is not so good. And come to places where they have parties where there's no alcohol, like our potluck. And I think, for me, I think it's actually one of the contributions, it's a small one, Patini, but I think it's a wonderful thing that we have a social gathering where there's food and there's no alcohol as part of it. And maybe we take it for granted, some of us who come all the time, but I think it's actually really meaningful for some people to have that kind of safety and security come to a place like this. So get out of trouble, stay out of trouble. So a lot of the Buddhist teachings support this. Teachings on ethics, for example, are a lot to do about staying out of trouble. And there's plenty of situations where I think, well, you know, the consequences of my lack of ethics, you know, it's, I can, you know, if people find out, it'll be okay, I'll deal with it. I can, you know, it's not such, it's not just a big thing. And there's all kinds of ways in which people are willing to kind of slide with their ethical life. And you know, it's not, you know, if you want to be safe, if you want to stay out of trouble, live an ethical life. And I know from my life, you know, over the years of practice, my ethics have, you know, slowly gotten better and better. Unfortunately, because of, you know, learning, being burned by it, you know, by sometimes seeing, I wish I had played it safe. You know, now I understand what these Buddhist teachings are teaching about, you know, creating safety for myself and for others, because this doesn't feel good, what happened here. So ethics is a very important aspect of staying out of trouble. Meditating every day is a way of staying out of trouble, because you have a certain stability of mind that allows you to see what's going on and maybe not be so reactive. And then developing good habits, good qualities of mind, taking some responsibility for the states of mind that you have, your emotional life, your inner life. And I think one of the beautiful qualities of human life is that we can develop ourselves. We can train the mind to be different than what it is. And it's well known in athletes, musicians, artists, craftspeople, in all kinds of professions, it's understood you need to develop yourself, develop certain capacities. And it's not a foreign thing to what people do. And so in this very ordinary part of human life of developing ourselves, it's possible to then think about what kind of inner development do I want that supports me on the path to freedom? And the Buddha listed seven qualities that can be developed that are particularly supportive for the Buddhist path. And one of them is, the first one is mindfulness. The second is investigation. For now, we'll just call it curiosity. Being interested in what's going on. More than just being present for what's going on, being interested in what's going on. The third is having good energy, to apply yourself, being kind of energized in, you know, an appropriate way. So what does it take to develop good energy? So you're not always tired or run down. Some people have choices they can make that can increase the amount of energy they have so they can apply themselves more fully and more directly in on the path. The next one is joy. It's an ordinary thing to have joy, isn't it? It's not exotic, I hope. And so you take the human capacity for joy and see what you can do to develop it, develop that capacity. And what brings you joy? What brings you healthy joy? It's often pointed out that a certain sense of well-being and happiness and joy maybe are not so far away. And sometimes it's just a matter of slowing down a teeny bit, taking a deep breath and looking around and realize, wait a minute, things are pretty nice at this moment. Or there's nice people. I mean, there's really nice people in this room. Really nice people. And maybe because I know a lot of these people. Maybe some of you don't. Take my word for it. But it brings me joy. If I just kind of, you know, stop talking about Buddhism. And take a moment to take in, you know, who's in this room here. I feel a lot of joy. It's just really neat. And it wasn't far away. But you know, sometimes giving yourself the time to take in the blessings, the fortunate things that are going on, can bring some joy. And it's worthwhile doing that. To be harried and busy and always ambitious and filling your time with every possible thing for some imagined future happiness sometimes is not so good. You know, you're kind of interrupting, you're kind of precluding the possibility of some nice, good feeling here and now. So joy. Next one is concentration. To develop your capacity to concentrate, to be focused. To not just be mindful in the present moment, really focused, really engaged, present. It's very, very helpful. It's said that you can't really develop the Buddhist path to its fulfillment without the ability to really be concentrated, be focused on what you're doing. The next one is tranquility. For now, we can just call it calm. To cultivate, develop your capacity for calm. And people will protest. You know, if I'm calm, it's okay, but I want to live a passionate life, you know, full of joy and excitement and all these wonderful things. And these Buddhists, you know, they're kind of like these party-pooping Buddhists. But you know, remember that in this list, the calm part comes after the joy part. So, you know, you're not asked to kind of give up your joy. You're supposed to add calm to it, which is, makes it really sweet, really nice. And then the last one is equanimity, which is different than calm. Equanimity is a balance of mind. And no matter what happens, your mind can stay balanced and kind of equanimous situation. So to develop these things, to spend some time in thinking about what is it that can cultivate to strengthen these things. Sometimes they can be strengthened just out of putting yourself in the right environment. Certain environments support some of these qualities coming out. Some of them can come out by intentionally trying to cultivate and develop these things. Another quality that can be developed is compassion. And I think it's one of the most sacred things. Really, I think of it as sacred. Capacity for compassion and kindness. And that part of the path, the Buddhist path, is to cultivate a degree of compassion and develop that capacity. Spend time. See what you can do to kind of support that happening in your life. And then once you develop these good qualities, keep them up. Maintain them. I see in myself that certain qualities, good qualities, things I appreciate that I have, that if I don't keep them up, if I don't keep them going, will start fading away. Certain qualities don't just kind of, you know, they're not kind of locked in. So think about these four right efforts. And as you get good at it and thinking about it and apply it for the purposes you want to live your life by, then they become more effortless and easier with time. And you get more sensitive to the subtleties of how your mind works. And you start, at some point, start seeing that perhaps the sense that there might be some, one of the subtle things you might see is that there's a sense of self, self-identity, self, the way you hold yourself, which is wrong effort, harmful effort. You're getting in trouble. And if you're living a kind of a coarse, so-called coarse life, busy life, or you don't know yourself very well, you might not realize how much selfing there is, how much you kind of strong attitude of, you know, I'm in command, I'm in control, or I'm terrible. I, me, myself, and I are a big part of how you operate. And so as you start getting better at this process of the four right efforts, then you start seeing at some point the self that's being infused in it. And as you start seeing it more and more clearly, then there's opportunity to begin dropping that effort of always finding self in the middle of everything, always being self-referential in a neurotic way. And then slowly, perhaps, or quickly, dropping the neurotic self-referential ways in which we engage in our efforts in our human life. And one of the really beautiful things about making effort, I love making effort. One of the beautiful things making effort is making effort when seemingly there's no self there, or there's no neurotic self. No kind of fixed idea that you have to prove yourself or defend yourself or be something for anybody. You can make effort without needing to be anything. Making effort because it's beautiful to make effort. Make effort because it's beautiful to cultivate and develop those consequences, those results in our life. So as the path goes along, it's kind of self-correcting. And because we're trying to make the right effort is satisfying. Right effort is freeing. And as we kind of negotiate these four right efforts, we tend to understand how to do them. Any deleterious ways in which you do it with time falls away, and the beneficial ways become stronger and stronger. And as they become stronger and stronger, some of the deleterious ways in which we hold ourselves and see ourselves fall away as well. And eventually, it's so beautiful. Just kind of the free movement of effort, of connecting to the world, taking responsibility in the world, helping out in the world. The world needs tremendous help. It needs people. Who's engaged. It doesn't need people who just sit in their cushion all day. It needs people who are engaged. But can you engage it in the world in a way that brings benefit to yourself and to others? Can you do it from your freedom? From your freedom. And the last thing I'll say is when the Buddha was first asked to teach, he said, to paraphrase him, again, I don't want you, today I don't want to use kind of exotic Buddhist words because then you'll all get turned off. But he said, the doors to your freedom are wide open here and now. They're right here. The doors to freedom are open for those who are sensitive, those who can see or those who can hear. So the four right efforts will get us to that door, which is here and always open. May you walk through. Thank you.